This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We've heard much in recent months about the crisis the Catholic Church is facing in terms of priests abusing children. Yesterday on this program, we heard from a former ward of the state of Illinois about adults in the system entrusted with the care of children who violate that trust. Sexual abusers can be either male or female and of any age, race, and economic background. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll learn what we can do to protect kids from abuse. Our guest is psychologist Dr. Lee Baker, an expert on child abuse. She's treated abused kids and their families for over 15 years. She's the founder of the Trauma Treatment Center of Colorado. She founded the center in 1990. Today, she supervises its outpatient clinic. Lee Baker is the author of the new book, Protecting Your Children from Sexual Predators. She is also the author of When Your Child's Been Abused, A Parent's Handbook. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Dr. Baker. Join us with a telephone call. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Dr. Baker, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. Sure. Good afternoon.
It seems at this moment in time we're seeing so many reports of sexual abuse. How widespread is the problem?
Well, you know, there's many different statistics, and as I researched the statistics for my book, I found many, many different numbers. And the estimate back in 2001 was that 1.2 million families will report child sexual abuse by the end of that year, and that's just those that are reported. When I went to the State Department to collect information about sexual abuse, they estimated that that number was actually three times higher, because these are only the cases that are reported and that get to the police departments and the judicial systems. So it is estimated that one in four children will be exposed to some form of sexual abuse before they reach adulthood.
And can we say whether or not this is a crime that's on the increase?
Well, that's another important thing. I think years ago we did not have the reporting mechanisms that we have now, and many people didn't report sexual abuse. I think it's been around for as long as recorded history, and possibly before that. But one of the things that we are seeing right now is because there are 24 million children regularly surfing the Internet, we do know that this sexual abuse of children has mutated to a stronger and more virulent virus that is adapted to certainly the technological age. And out of these 24 million children, there is estimated that one in five of them will be either view unexpected pornography or will be exposed to sexual solicitation on the Internet. So I think that the Internet poses a very new problem that is increasing the risk of our children being exposed to sexual abuse. Mm.
So what advice do you have for keeping kids safe while they're on their computer?
Well, while they're on the computer, I have a number of things that I advocate. Children are very technologically savvy these days, and I think it is very easy for them to surf the Internet and to go into places that parents may not even understand. So the first thing I advocate is that parents learn the computer. They become as savvy as their children so that they understand what sites their children are visiting, how to get access to those sites, and they understand the ways in which their children can be exposed to pornography over the Internet. Because if they are completely unaware of how a computer operates, how the Internet operates, then they are not going to be able to warn their children about all the different areas such as bulletin boards, chat rooms, emails, and other, you know, other parts of the Internet that their child that could pose a problem. So I recommend that parents learn the computer. I also recommend that a child not spend a long period of time alone on a computer. I advocate that the computer be used like the television, VCRs, that it is used as family entertainment. and that it is kept in a family room, and that a child does not have their own password, that there's a family password, that the family use the internet to gain information, explore different areas that they're interested in, and as a way of, you know, aiding communication. And of course, if a child has homework, that a child can go on the internet, but that a parent is always has access to the sites a child has been visiting. And, you know, they can talk to the child about that. And the other thing that is very important is to develop a computer safety program at home to explain to children all the different areas that that can be harmful on the computer, and actually have a list of do's and don'ts, such as never giving personal information out, never exchanging other types of information, such as school and you know where they live and various information like that can be very, very, very dangerous, that they never agree on any circumstances to meet with someone they have met online without their parents' permission and without a parent accompanying them. Children have to understand that who they meet online, they may think that this is a teenager, another child, but in actuality may be a very, very cunning sexual predator who knows how to use the internet to gain access to children.
Hmm. Dr. Lee Baker is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with her about how we can protect our children from sexual predators. Listeners, your telephone calls are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener already waiting to talk with us, so let's go to this caller in Aurora on the toll-free line and talk to them.
I just wanted, this isn't about sexual problems, but I wanted to ask you, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine. She has a friend in another state. They live in another state. And she was telling me that her friend's daughter-in-law drinks a bottle of wine every day and abuses her husband. She abuses the husband. The six-year-old child has an attention deficit learning problem. Now, I told her I thought the child was being abused to see the father being abused by the mother. And we had quite a discussion about this, and I wondered if you could have any input into this.
Well, it's one of the things we do know is that children witnessing domestic violence in the home are definitely subject to many emotional and behavioral problems.
Yeah, he was put out of one school already in first grade.
Right. Now, whether it warrants, I think it certainly warrants family intervention and family counseling. And whether it warrants actual abuse to a child, witnessing domestic violence in and of itself can be, if it's very severe, in certain states, social services can see that as an abuse and neglect case and can open up the case and then investigate the child further. And investigate the family further, but it would need to be reported, and it would need to be severe enough that social services would feel like they would have to intervene. But I would say the first step would be to get a counselor involved with this family as soon as possible.
But this could be classified as a potential problem.
It is a problem, not a potential. When a child witnesses abuse, that is what they learn to model.
Yes, and that's exactly the point I thought. That poor child has to witness and grow up and think that that's the right thing to do.
That's right.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. How should parents talk with their children about sexual predators? What's the appropriate age for that conversation to begin?
Well, it's very interesting because parents are always asking me, won't I alarm a child?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't talk to my 3-year-old or 2-year-old about sexuality or sexual issues or abuse. It will frighten them, or maybe it'll make them too curious. One of the things I advocate is that sexuality be talked about in the home like any other areas of development, that it is a normal topic of discussion when a child asks questions about it, that it is, and that it is dealt with in that kind of way, such as if a child wants to learn about anything, that it just be discussed and be open. We find that in families that have open communication, there is a much less chance of a child being sexually abused. And we also find that talking to children honestly and openly about sexuality, and that again is the good parts of sexuality, the normal parts of healthy sexual developments, as well as the problems and what perils may befall them, we find that these children have less anxiety and feel more empowered and feel much less afraid. Children are exposed in the media to many things going on, and unless parents begin to really explain and talk to them about these issues, children will learn from one another and they may get misinformation. I advocate that parents begin to talk to their children young as 2 or 3, when they can begin to identify body parts, and when they can begin to discover their own bodies and the differences in bodies between boys and girls, and that a normal, healthy sexual education take place where children, you know, maybe can have access to books that are appropriate for children and ask questions. And also, this is a good time in which parents matter-of-factly can begin to explain to their children about good touch, bad touch, about not keeping secrets, about privacy, and also, you know, within the home, modeling that privacy. So, therefore, it becomes a normal part of the discussion. And if it is presented in a non-alarmist and informative way, children will feel very empowered. And if they feel like children who feel embarrassed to talk about sex or embarrassed to mention body parts are less likely to tell their parents when someone may have touched them inappropriately because they feel shamed. Mm. So open, honest discussion between all family members creates a family environment in which a child will be less vulnerable to sexual attack, and if they are unfortunately exposed to it, they are more likely to come to their parents and talk to them.
Mm. Dr. Baker, your book, Protecting Your Children from Sexual Predators, opens with the story of a family, mother, daughter, stepfather. Until the daughter actually tells the mother she's been abused by the stepfather, the mother has no idea about what's been going on. Is that often the case?
Well, that is often the case if a sexual predator is very savvy and if the situation allows for it. Let me explain what I mean. In the situation that I write about in the book, her husband and the child's stepfather was a sexual predator, and he had left a number of warning signs that this woman didn't understand or know how to interpret. For instance, he very rarely talked about his own past, and therefore there were parts of him that she didn't know. He appeared very charming, swept her off her feet. Perhaps there wasn't really enough time to begin to know a person and integrate this person into the family. There was also mention that he had had a child in a previous marriage and was estranged from this child. And he offered an explanation that his former wife and the mother of the child alienated the child from him. And this woman, you know, accepted this explanation. And again, if she had looked further into it, had talked more about his past and found out a little bit more about him, there would have been some warning signs about, an unsavory, so to speak, a past that would have warned her. There's also signs when the child is beginning to... the child and the predator will develop a very special kind of relationship, a very secretive relationship, and a very special relationship. And obviously the relationship has to be secretive in order for the abuse to occur. Now, in this particular story, he had touched her, and this child went shortly after to the mother. And so the abuse was not allowed to continue. And the child, you know, right before had become sullen and argumentative and angry. There will be behavioral change in children that will often precede or let the parent know that there is something alarming that is occurring.
What other kind of behavioral changes might a parent witness in a child?
And this is really important because I think we've had a lot of pamphlets that have been spread, you know, throughout the nation saying sleeplessness, bedwetting, and these are the 10 warning signs, and then parents become very anxious and think, is my child being sexually abused? So I want to give a caveat to this. The behavioral signs alone are not enough. They come in context with other issues. But one of the things that you want to look for is that a sudden change in any kind of behavior, it doesn't necessarily mean sexual abuse. What it means is the child is in distress. Mm-hmm. And the parent needs to find out more about it. So let's say even an infant. Infants, we know that infants go through grieving, and infants go through responses that can indicate that they have been in trauma. So even in infants, if there is a sudden change in eating, sleeping, or playing activities, which has no medical explanation, if an infant looks listless, if an infant looks bored or tired or, you know, staring into space, and during the preceding weeks or months they had never done that, then that is an indication that there's a sudden change. And as children grow older, you know, 2 years old, 4 years old, 6 years old, there's different constellations of changes. But again, they will be sudden, and some children will have a loss of behaviors that they had previously learned. They'll start baby talking. They'll start thumb sucking. They'll start, they'll act very regressed. And there can also be in children either a overactivity or underactivity, a loss of interest in activities that they used to enjoy. There can be bedwetting. There can be a sudden onset of soiling in the pants, of aggressiveness. One important behavior to look for in very young children is that children who've been exposed to sexual abuse will more often than not display sexual behaviors that reflect knowledge that is too old for them, mm-hmm. knowledge that they couldn't have gained otherwise. And it will also be more frequent, such as masturbation. And it will be more frequent, and it will be difficult for the child to stop. Or they may see the child engaging with another child in sex play that is, again, beyond what is normally expected in young children. And they may be mimicking something that young children wouldn't ordinarily know. So that is very important to look for. They may act it out with their dolls. They may act it out with puppets. So, again, children may give hints and clues, but certainly sexualized behavior is a very important clue to look at children.
Yeah. I want to go back to the story that we were talking about with the mother, the daughter, and the stepfather.
Right.
Because here I want to get to, you know, this mother did the right thing. She took immediate action.
That's right.
Talk with us about what that woman did once her daughter told her of the abuse, and maybe some also some general guidelines, general advice for if we suspect a problem.
Okay.
Where do we go from there?
Okay. Well, one of the things that is very important is the initial outcry of a child. And we find that parents, and often the initial outcry is made to parents. It could be made to preschool teachers, sisters, brothers, babysitters. But the important thing is that the parent's initial reaction will often determine the course of the child's response throughout the subsequent interviewing and as this is investigated. So parents should remain as calm as possible. often a child will pick up on a parent's agitation and anguish, and then they'll shut up completely and say, well, nothing happened. So parent must remain as calm as possible and let the child know that they did the right thing by telling, that they are, that it is not their fault and they will not get in trouble. And that the parent not try to get a lot of information. And this is where it's often difficult. Parents will want to know when, where, how many times, where did he touch you, what happened. I think the initial outcry, I think it's okay for parents to say, when did this happen, and let the child explain it, but not go into an in-depth interview with the child where they're really trying to find out all the information. And in a story, again, the mother did just that. She questioned the child, and then she called the authorities, which is very important. And parents can either call the local police station, or they can call their county's social service department. When they call the county social service department, they will call the child crisis team, and they will explain the child's allegation, and then it is up to social services to investigate and to question and to determine the credibility. It is not up to the parent or the teacher or anybody who reports it to determine the credibility. And that's what happens in the initial allegation. Sometimes a child will say something and then a mother will say, well, that doesn't make sense. That couldn't have happened. It can't be credible. So it's important that parents do listen to what their child is saying and then immediately report it to either the local police department or their county social service agency.
Protecting kids from sexual predators, in order to do that, we've got to have some information and we've got to be aware of the red flags.
That's right.
And your book does that. You talk about types of predators, you talk about common characteristics of predators, and I want to get to this information because I think it is so important. Talk with us first about the most common characteristics of predators.
Okay. One of the things that, you know, I do give 10 most common characteristics, but one of the things I wanted to let parents know that would be very helpful is that I interviewed over 100 of these predators, and they can be the most charming, seemingly well-meaning, nice people that you think you've ever met. And I've actually myself walked away from the interview thinking, I forgot why I was interviewing this man as a sexual predator, because they are so expert at deception and at making themselves appear who they think you want them to be. And I have had many parents say, but he, you know, the coach or the Girl Scout leader or the, you know, the babysitter he or she was the most wonderful person in the world. I would have never guessed. And that is important for parents to know. Don't assume that you know someone just because of how they're presenting to you, because these predators will present in a very, very deceptive way and often try to gain the trust of parents so that they can gain the access to the child. So that's a very important one. These, for the most part, for sexual predators, they have an incredible sense of entitlement. They believe that the world owes them a living and that, you know, that they're entitled to do certain things, and they'll give excuses why they did something. And that goes along with another characteristic, that they have a refusal or an inability to take responsibility for their actions. They will often blame the abuse on the child, the adolescent. They'll blame it on circumstances. They'll blame it on their own history. They'll blame it on the fact that they were drinking. And they have a difficult time really taking responsibility for their own actions. They also tend to see people as objects upon which they can use and upon which they use to gratify their own needs. So therefore, a child that they are going to abuse is not really seen as a person. That child is seen as an object upon which they use to gratify sexual, emotional, whatever needs that you know they're trying to get met. and they objectify their victims, and that's how they're able to, particularly the ones who amass so many victims, that's the way they're able to do that. They objectify them. They take the human qualities out of them.
Mm-hmm. And they lack empathy.
They definitely lack the empathy, because if you would think about it, if they truly had an ability to understand what their victim is going to go through, they would not do this. But they justify their actions, and they'll be able to justify it with, well, they wanted it, but they don't really understand child development. They don't understand the impact. Well, they do understand the impact, but they lack the empathy to be able to really put themselves in their victim's position. So that's an important one also. They often have a troubled childhood themselves, and they've had difficulty forming close interpersonal relationships with adults. They may have had many unsuccessful relationships and have difficulty getting their needs met in adult relationships. So, and there's often a drug and alcohol problem or a history of drug and alcohol problem, and they always show some sort of deviant sexual behavior. So that's it, and that's another. And the deviant sexual behavior can range from anything from an interest to child pornography, an interest in masochism or sadism, or just any kind of sexual problem. But when you interview the mates, the adult mates of these predators, there's often they often talk about sexual problems, either a high demand for sex or a loss of sex with the partner. So there's some type of sexual problems. And their sexual deviancy comes in the fact that they justify to themselves that it's okay to have sex with children.
Mm.
I don't know if I left anyone out here.
Yeah.
I'm not looking at the list, but I think I covered.
I think you did a great job.
Yeah, okay.
And there are different types of predators.
That's
well.
Right. That's right. There's well, one of the things that I try to do for parents is that there are so many different types. As you can see in the media now, they come from all walks of life.
Mm-hmm.
They can be media moguls. They can be priests. They can be rabbis. They can be teachers. They come in male. They come with as male and female. They can be older children, the babysitter next door, the kindly old man who lives down the street. There are about as many sexual predators as there are people in the world. So it is very, very difficult to classify them. But what I wanted to give parents an idea is to go into depth into the four main types so that they would have an idea and become more familiar with this kind of person. Because in actuality, most predators have characteristics of two or three of these. But I gave an example of a narcissistic predator, and this is a man who, or a woman who believes that the world is theirs for the taking and that everybody is there to meet their needs and that they are basically able to do things that other people aren't. They are given license to do things that other people aren't because they are special and unique and endowed with these abilities. And these people really feel justified in their abuse of children. Many of these types of predators will pick young adolescents, 12, 13, 14, and then again in an interest in regaining their own youth or in gaining control, because again they like to take control, they will pick a young girl and then justify it. Narcissistic predators often have good jobs. They're often in positions of power and control, which, again, they can use to manipulate their victims.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the antisocial predator who is, again, very, very dangerous because this type of antisocial, which we used to call the sociopath, has little to no conscience, and they do not feel remorse for what they have done. If they're caught, they may say, yes, it was wrong, but they truly have no ability to feel empathy and to feel remorse because they have little to no conscience. And these are people who will, again, not necessarily sexually abuse children. They will abuse a whole range of people, and sexual abuse of children is one of the many infractions that they, so to speak, that they may commit. And these antisocial predators are usually involved in other illegal pursuits, such as it might be in child pornography or solicitation and trafficking of child pornography.
There was a story in the New York Times yesterday about a boarding school that is facing a number of accusations of child sexual abuse. And this, I think, fits right in with this type of abuser, the antisocial abuser. It turns out that a convicted chronic child molester played an important role in proposing people for the school to hire. Apparently, he was a donor, you know, gave money to the school.
Right.
And in turn, he had a voice in suggesting who the school should hire. And the people he suggested who were hired were also child molesters.
Right.
What can you tell us about, for lack of any other way to put it, what I'd call gangs of predators?
Well, and that does happen because, especially with the Internet, they're able to mingle and justify their actions. And I think organizations like NAMBLA certainly use that, the social, in their social acceptance of child molestation and having other people around who also do the same thing to, quote, normalize the behavior. And it's also used in many ways as a form of voyeurism, and again, to increase the sexual appetite of the predator, that there are other people doing it, that they can be voyeuristic with it and control. But again, we do find that there are certain types of predators that are isolative and that only, again, you know, move in their own, by themselves, and are very, very withdrawn and socially inadequate people. But for those who aren't and who enjoy having company, like the narcissist and the antisocial, who enjoy the thrill of getting other people involved in illicit activity, they will form groups, and that will be much harder to infiltrate and to break open.
Mm. Dr. Lee Baker is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Protecting Your Children from Sexual Predators. She is an expert on child abuse. She's treated abused kids and their families for over 15 years. Protecting Your Children from Sexual Predators is the title of her new book. She's also the author of When Your Child's Been Abused, A Parent's Handbook. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions, comments, they're invited. You can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Are women who abuse children different from men who abuse children? Are there differences?
There are certain differences, but you have to understand that the women that we study who have been adjudicated by the system are often the most, have committed the most heinous of sexual abuse against children. And we find that many women who have committed sexual abuse are not indicted. And the reason is that judges are often more lenient with women. There is a societal image of women that says a woman could never abuse a child, and therefore they're given a lot more leeway in their behaviors with children than men are. But when we're actually beginning to research it, and in my own experiences, we're finding that women are comprising a larger number than we thought of sexual predators. Women tend to... some of the differences are women tend to couch their abuse more in forms of a relationship than men. So we find that women will develop more of a relationship and explain the sexual abuse in terms of really falling in love with their victim and of having a relationship with their victim, being a mentor to their victim, teaching their victim. And women tend to justify that in ways that men do at times, but not as frequently as women.
Mm-hmm.
So again, and we're also looking at some of the women that we have found, that we've studied, and again, because of the pool of women we have to select from are, again, the most severe cases, they tend to have more emotional problems, very severe emotional problems. They also have a higher incidence than men of committing the abuse with a partner, committing the abuse either with a boyfriend, a husband, the children's stepfather, or a lover. So they have a somewhat higher tendency to do that in conjunction with a man. So there are some differences, although, you know, again, we find these women in every walk of life, just as we do the male predator. But again, because of the pool we have to select to study from, we tend to see the most severe cases. And again, these women are usually very severely disturbed and, again, are in less financial, they have less financial economic status than their male counterparts. But they take the child through the same stages of sexual abuse as men do and need the same type of treatment.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one, so let's go and talk with this caller. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
First, I wanted to say that I really respect your research, because I think it must be very difficult research to do, but the information is so valuable to parents.
Thank you.
I wanted to thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome.
I have a question. I know that there was Megan's Law passed
years
ago, and as a parent who is just scared to death about this stuff, I was wondering how one gets a listing of sexual predators that might be in the area, convicted sexual predators?
Right. Great question. I have a listing in the book, actually, but you can get that.
Okay.
Let me explain Megan's Law. There's two parts of Megan's Law. One is the registration of sexual offenders, so that sexual offenders have to register. Number two is the community notification. In other words, a community has to, and that's actually called the Jacob Wetterling Law. That's part of it. And that's where the community must be or should be notified when a predator is in their neighborhood or in the schools or whatever. But there are many, many, many problems with this, and I want to talk to parents about this, because the sex offender registry in your state, you need to know what kinds of sexual offenders are registered, whether they're the most violent or whether they're committed other kinds of sexual offenses, because some states only list the violent sexual offenders. Mm-hmm. Another thing is you need to know when the law went into effect. What year? Because you may have a predator living in your neighborhood that, you know, sexually abused a child before the law went into effect. And third, you need to find out how your community notifies you. I have found in my research, in most states, you can get it on the internet. Some states do not, however, have internet access, and you have to go down to the local police station and get that information. What you can do is there's a website on Megan Kanka Society or Megan's Law.
Okay.
And if you type in Megan's Law, there are websites there is a website that will give you each state and an update on the laws in each state and how you get notification.
Okay.
And be careful with it too, because again, you have to understand that it won't completely, I mean, in some instances, you still may have a sexual predator living in your neighborhood that hasn't been identified. And the other thing that you can do, this is really important, is if in a daycare or a preschool or a school or a church, you should make sure that that institution has done background checks on every person working there. And they may not have to give you the information on each person, but they can give you a registered letter or a certified letter saying that there is no one in their institution that is dangerous or that has ever been on a sex offender registry list. Mm-hmm. And that's another important thing that parents can do, because it's also letting the facility know that you are going to check up on it.
Right. I know for my son's preschool, we all had to be fingerprinted and
right, good.
And go through that whole scenario. And while it was time-consuming, I really did appreciate the fact that they were worried about that.
That's great.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. You're very welcome.
Thanks for the call. We're going to go and talk with another listener now on the toll-free line in Eureka. Good afternoon.
I just have information for Illinois. The state police publish it. I'm in the Eureka area, outside probably where the Peoria TV stations, but if a caller would go to WEEK.com, and then scroll down to links to other stories, there's a link to the Illinois State Police Registry, and it does it by county, by
right.
cities, and zip codes. So
that's very important. Thank you for that. Right.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, going back to that caller who asked about the registry, you know, she said she's afraid,
right.
and rightfully so.
Right.
On the other hand, it's really important to strike the right balance, to be protective but
that's
not
right.
alarmist.
That's right. That's very true. And the hope in writing this book and the hope in teaching parents this is that knowledge is power, and power empowerment can make you feel safer. And if you really understand, I think what happens is parents may get alarmed because they have some information but not enough. And they get a lot of the information from the media, and a lot of it is, you know, media-related. And so they may form opinions and become frightened based on just a limited amount of knowledge. And if they really have a full breadth of the whole situation and understanding of the different contexts upon which sexual abuse can occur and how the relationships develop, I think they will be less alarmed. And I'm hoping that the information that I give parents will make them less alarmed and feel more empowered that I can do this. This will be okay.
Mm. We've got to wrap up pretty quickly here. But before we go, I want to touch on one other important area that your book talks about at length. But I do want to give listeners a sense of this, the five stages of abuse. In the next 2.5-3 minutes, can you give us a summation of the stages of abuse?
Right. You know, a predator will take a their victim through stages, and they're very, very predictable stages, very predictable. The first one is they're going to detect. They're very cunning in detecting the most vulnerable children. And that doesn't mean that the child is to blame on any level.
Right.
They will detect children who perhaps are needy, want attention, who have just been through a crisis, and those kinds of things. So they'll detect the vulnerable children. The next step is they're going to approach, and they will usually approach as a friend on a very benign level. They may approach the family as a friend, and they will begin again to collect more information about the child's personality, what the child's needing, and how best to approach this child. The third stage is they're going to begin the subjugation, and this is the stage in which they begin to gain control over the child in small measures, whether it be control over who the child plays with, what the child tells them, what secrets the child will keep, and that kind of thing. They may begin giving presents or promises, again, things that will be used to gain control. And this is also a stage where they begin to prepare the child for keeping secrets. The next stage is the grooming. The grooming stage is very important in that it prepares the child for the actual sexual abuse. So there may be a more of an exposure to sexuality. They may show some sexual books or magazines or some TV shows or talk about sexual things with the child. They may be more hand-holding or stroking or close physical contact. And they're beginning to groom, and again, to prepare the child for the actual sexual abuse. And then the final act is the actual sexual abuse that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's much more to each stage. I was just trying to, again, make it, let parents mm-hmm. know that there are stages that, you know, they can definably see.
Well, there's a very thorough discussion
right.
of the stages in the book.
And one of the most important things I just wanted to say is that a parent should never allow a child to enter into an exclusive and secretive relationship with an adult or an older child. They should always have access to that relationship.
Very good. Dr. Baker, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Lee Baker has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the founder of the Trauma Treatment Center of Colorado. She founded the center in 1990. She's been treating abused kids and their families for over 15 years. She's a psychologist. She's the author of two books for parents on this topic. She's the author of Protecting Your Children from Sexual Predators and When Your Child's Been Abused, a Parent's Handbook.